Iraq's trade minister says Iraq has lost about $140 billion because of the U.S.-UN sanctions, which include a ban on oil exports. He also says 1.5 million Iraqis, most of them children, have died from food and medicine shortages caused by the sanctions. The sanctions were imposed in 1990. The U.N. Security Council says it won't lift them until inspectors certify that Iraq has eliminated all its weapons of mass destruction. Meanwhile, this week, one of the largest delegations ever to go to Iraq is headed there, bringing large amounts of food and medicine. We'll have more on that story tomorrow. Meanwhile, Iraq's Deputy Prime Minister Tariq Aziz lambasted fellow Arab states for what he said was subservience to U.S. hegemony in the Middle East and their support for punitive U.N. sanctions against Iraq. This news from Nigeria. The authorities there arrested 20 people, including two prominent opposition politicians, after a riot in a southwestern city left dozens of cars and several homes burned. Seven people were killed in the riot this weekend, which broke out during a demonstration against the military rule of General Sani Abacha. Police reportedly opened fire on the crowd. This news from Jakarta. Police fired tear gas at students on four Indonesian campuses this weekend as tens of thousands of protesters held anti-government rallies at universities nationwide. And this news from El Salvador. The Roman Catholic Church there called yesterday for a thorough investigation into the 1980 killings of four U.S. church workers after reports that those convicted now say they were carrying out orders from above. Roman Catholic nuns Dorothy Kazell and Ida Ford, Maura Clark, and lay worker Jean Donovan were stopped on a rural road December 2, 1980, raped and shot to death. Five former National Guardsmen were convicted in the killings of the women, who the military saw as sympathetic to guerrillas who had launched an insurgency a year before. The Clinton administration is seeking to scrap a law that would impose a one-year moratorium on U.S. use of anti-personnel landmines. The moratorium was signed into law 2 years ago, but only comes into effect next February 12th. Its drafters reportedly hope the measure would spur the Pentagon to search for alternatives to anti-personnel mines. The White House joined House Democrats yesterday in a furious assault on Congressmember Dan Burton, the Republican of Indiana, accusing him of doctoring transcripts of former Associate Attorney General Webster Hubbell's prison phone calls to exclude declarations of innocence about matters still under investigation. Burton's the chair of the House Government Reform and Oversight Committee. He shrugged off the accusations, saying that anyone who's investigated the president has been mercilessly attacked. He said in a statement that he would begin today to release in their entirety the 54 conversations that were excerpted to show that there were no attempts to doctor or distort their content. Burton and his staff last week released a 27-page document containing portions of phone conversations Hubbell had with his wife and others. Right-wing Israeli lawmakers are threatening to topple Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu's government if any more West Bank land is transferred to the Palestinians. Netanyahu is in London meeting with U.S. Secretary of State Madeleine Albright to discuss the scope of the next Israeli withdrawal. And that's some of the news at this hour. You're listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. As the Dalai Lama continues his two-week tour of the United States this week, Indian police have begun a crackdown on Tibetan activists on a hunger strike. Police hospitalized six strikers after 49 days, and six more have begun a strike in their place. One Tibetan activist died last week after he set himself on fire to protest the police crackdown. The self-immolation was the first by a Tibetan protesting Chinese occupation. The six activists who remain in the hospital have vowed to continue the strike once they're released. Meanwhile, Chinese President Jiang Zemin in Beijing last week refused to discuss Tibet with U.S. Secretary of State Madeleine Albright. We're joined right now by Nancy Jo Johnson. She's a freelance journalist who traveled to India last month on assignment for the International Campaign for Tibet and Witness, part of the International Lawyers for Human Rights. She spent 8 days with the Tibetan hunger strikers and was there when the Dalai Lama visited the camp in April. Welcome to Democracy Now!, Nancy Jo Johnson.
Thank you very much.
Well, can you explain what the picture is there in New Delhi, what it looks like, where the protesters are?
They are holding the strike in a place called Jantar Mantar, which is a park in Connaught Circle in New Delhi. And amidst the 100-degree heat, they are laying on cots underneath a very makeshift tent. They are being visited, you know, or they were being before they were taken when I was there. They're being visited by Tibetans throughout India, Nepal. They even had some visitors from New York. When I was there, they were entering their 23rd, 24th day of the hunger strike, and at that time appeared to be extremely weak. They were all still speaking. There was one, a man named Dawa Gelpo, who at that time was unable to get up and move around by himself, although the other five were, in fact, getting up and walking around on occasion. I interviewed each one of them individually right before I left on the last day regarding what their message was, both to Tibetans inside Tibet and outside of Tibet. And they expressed, you know, through their great clarity and courage and commitment to the people in their homeland, that as they talked, they spoke of how they are living in a jail, and they hoped that the Tibetans inside Tibet would not lose their courage, that the people outside of Tibet, and of course their going on hunger strike is a symbol of the strength of the Tibetans in exile, working with them, trying to raise awareness, you know, all over the world.
Nancy Jo Johnson, we're also joined on the telephone by Yangchen Dolkar, who is the secretary of the Tibetan Youth Conference, the conference which is sponsoring the hunger strike. And Yangchen Dolkar speaks to us from Dharamsala. Welcome to Democracy Now! Can you hear me?
Yes, I can hear you.
Can you tell us there how the Tibetan community is reacting to the hunger strike, how much support there is? I understand that Dalai Lama was lukewarm on the strike, not exact saying that he didn't approve of people doing violence to themselves, but he understood the commitment.
Yes, the anti-death hunger strike organized by the Tibetan Youth Congress in New Delhi was not only a result in the international media, but it also moved the Tibetan community. It also mobilized the Tibetan community to be more active towards the Tibetan freedom movement. And the hunger strike unto death by the six people sacrificing their life for the cause of Tibet have really affected and moved the Tibetan, you know, starting from a very young age, where the Tibetan Children's Village and the other Tibetan schools have written. The way they have written to the six hunger strikers, one cannot read it properly, that you get so emotional that this student who's 6-7 years old writes to the hunger strikers saying that whatever the six, the young child of 6 year old, he said, Tenzin, he said, whatever I eat, I pray that my food nutrition goes to all of you. So these are the one example of what the younger generation, you know, concern and supports toward the hunger strikers. So this hunger strike unto death has really moved the Tibetan community itself here in exile, and also encouragement towards the Tibetans inside Tibet who has been really struggling under the Chinese repression for the last 39 years. So this organizing of hunger strike unto death has also helped a lot for the Tibetans inside Tibet to continue their struggle under the Chinese repression.
We wanted to talk for a minute about Thupten Godup. He was one of the hunger strikers who protested the fact that the police, the New Delhi police, were taking the protesters to the hospital and forcing them to eat. And on April 27th, he poured kerosene over himself. He was a former monk and struck a match, walked out from behind the banner demanding independence for Tibet. Let me ask you, Nancy Jo Johnson, were you there at the time?
I was not. I wasn't there at the time. But in fact, I was present Thursday night in New York City at the Temple of Emmanuel when the Dalai Lama spoke of his witness, of Thupten Godup, who in fact set his body on fire last week. I would just have to go back for a second to your comment about His Holiness being lukewarm about the issue. I think that His Holiness, the 14th Dalai Lama of Tibet, is everything but lukewarm. He has been tremendously moved and, you know, probably, I can't exactly say, you know, perfectly, but in fact, when I witnessed his discussion on Thursday night, he spoke very much from the heart when he described seeing Thupten Godup a couple hours before he died in the hospital. He gave the following description. He said that here was a man laying in a hospital bed who was covered all over his body with you know, horrific burns. He could not see. He could not speak. But in fact, he could hear. And there was somebody in the room with His Holiness, the Dalai Lama, who told Thupten Godup that the Dalai Lama was standing next to him. And Thupten Godup was able to raise his hands and, in a prayer, folding his hands at his heart, was able to greet the Dalai Lama. And this was, you know, quite an extraordinary effort by this person. His Holiness also said that he was comforted that Thupten Godup's mind was very clear, that he was very encouraged by the determination of this man to sacrifice his life for the cause of Tibet. Back in April, when I was with the hunger strikers and the Dalai Lama visited, one of the last things that he said was, I in fact can't offer them any alternatives at this point. I'm extremely encouraged by, you know, their determination. And he said, it is these six Tibetans who are starving themselves, it is like a symbol of Tibet dying in front of the civilized world. So in fact, I think that the struggle of Tibet that is actually being witnessed to the world through these incredibly courageous Tibetans on the outside has moved the issue of Tibet to the forefront with of people's consciousness, but it has to be bigger and it has to be more. It has to be taken up on a government level.
Yangchen Dolkar, you are secretary of the Tibetan Youth Conference in Dharamsala, India. I wanted to ask you to respond to a piece that's on the front page of the Christian Science Monitor today. It talks about what the protesters have been doing, and it talks about Mr. Godup dying after immolating himself. But then it talks about how the Dalai Lama is beginning to be criticized or his authority questioned. One quote is, there is stagnation in the Tibetan struggle caused by indecision on the part of the leadership and a lack of political will to take the necessary steps to achieve results. Now, that's a quote of Lhasang Tsering, former president of the Tibetan Youth Congress. Is that the same as your organization? He's the former president of your group.
Yeah.
What is your response to that? Would you say that because we're talking about an occupation that's been going on for some, 39 years now, that people are getting frustrated, fed up with the Dalai Lama's leadership? Does he express a majority point of view? Well, I'm having trouble understanding you, so I'm going to put that question to Nancy Jo Johnson. You interviewed a lot of Tibetans while you were in New Delhi. Where does he stand in the spectrum?
The I think that there is a level of frustration that is being experienced by certainly the Tibetans in exile and even the support groups because of the lack of movement as far as seeing any change inside of Tibet. The frustration with the Dalai Lama specifically is it's a very complex and difficult issue for me as a non-Tibetan to address. I do believe that there is a sense of discouragement by many Tibetans, especially those who are presently coming out of Tibet. They are escaping based on, you know, the horrific conditions inside, and the ones that I specifically spoke with during my interviews over the last 2 months. And a couple times I was it wasn't so much to the Dalai Lama specifically as it was to the situation of the exiled community, that there was this feeling that the exile community isn't doing enough, and that they felt that there have been signs of a lack of courage, and I am, you know, specifically not quoting perfectly, but paraphrasing a couple of political prisoners who I spoke with in Dharamsala. I do believe that the Dalai Lama remains, you know, very much at the heart of the Tibetan community in exile, and that the Tibetan administration is working, you know, tremendously hard to try and resolve this situation.
Let me ask you about a question we get every time we do something on Tibet. One particular listener calls and says, why don't you talk about the feudal nature of Tibet before China moved in, and the fact that the Dalai Lama still has total control, and that we're not talking about a democracy here.
I think that, you know, there have been a lot of changes, you know, that the Tibetan government in exile have had to deal with. The Dalai Lama himself is one of the strongest spokespersons of trying to encourage more of a democratic government. He has, you know, worked tirelessly to convince the Tibetan community to speak up and you know, even to debate with him about issues and the way that he is confronting the situation. I mean, he obviously stands very, very steadfast in his belief of a nonviolent path, but it doesn't mean, like, for example, with the hunger strikers, that he is, you know, of course, he doesn't agree with any type of violence, and does feel that this hunger strike is a sort of self-inflicted violence. But, you know, he at the same time finds great great encouragement by their strength. I'm not sure that I'm answering your question directly. I think that he, you know, again, he is the biggest spokesperson for this change that needs to happen within the administration in exile, and would like very much to, you know, as he often says, you know, step aside from this kind of political responsibility that he has. But given the nature of their experience in exile, obviously that's not possible at this time.
Nancy Jo Johnson, you were doing photographs for Life magazine?
I have, yes. I was not this particular trip, but last summer I was on assignment for Life magazine and was in Tibet for the fourth time, the first time being in 1987, and then, you know, most recently 10 years later in 1997. And yes, I was working for Life at the time.
Well, I want to thank you very much for joining us, Nancy Jo Johnson, freelance photojournalist who traveled in India last month on assignment for the International Campaign for Tibet, and also Yang Chandolkar. That phone call broke up a bit, but talking to us from Dharamsala, India, secretary of the Tibetan Youth Conference. And by the way, if you would like to get in touch with the U.S.-Tibet Committee, you can call 212-481-3569. That's 212-481-3569. Next up, we go south to Guatemala, where last week one of the bishops was assassinated. Stay with us. This is Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now!, the exception to the rulers. I'm Amy Goodman. Last week's assassination of Guatemalan Bishop Juan Gerardi Conadera in Guatemala City drew a sharp response from the Catholic Church officials, who said the government of Guatemala will face serious repercussions if the murder's not solved within 72 hours. Now the Guatemalan government claims to have a suspect in custody, but many are suspicious about who they've gotten. The United States sent members of the FBI to aid in the investigation. However, some Guatemalans question the presence of U.S. intelligence forces, given the history of U.S. government support of widespread atrocities and murders over the past four decades in Guatemala. Bishop Juan Gerardi had just completed a report entitled Never Again, a searing indictment of the Guatemalan military and paramilitary organization's campaign of terror against the people of Guatemala. He was bludgeoned to death just as the report was being released, just a few days after he participated in a news conference releasing that report. We're now joined by a personal friend of the bishop. He's Frank LaRue, a Guatemalan lawyer. He lived in exile in Washington, D.C. for 12 years. He's now returned to Guatemala, where he's the director of the Center for Human Rights Legal Action in Guatemala City. Welcome to Democracy Now!
Thanks. It's a pleasure to be on Democracy Now!
If you could speak as loud as you possibly can, because we're having a little trouble hearing you. I'm wondering if we can start off by you explaining what the response has been in Guatemala City to the assassination of Bishop Gerardi.
Oh, there has been a tremendous outrage by all sectors of the population. This was a terrible blow, not only against the Catholic Church, which was very hurt, obviously, by the murder of one of its finest bishops, but also it's a blow against all society. It is a message to everyone that is working on human rights. And this not only includes human rights organizations like us, but it particularly includes those that were the victims or the witnesses of these atrocities of the past and that had come forward to give their testimony to the report of the church or to the report of the Truth Commission, which is about to come out on July 31st. It is also a message to the government. Many governments, civilian governments, have had their authority seriously limited by people within the security forces by serious political murder, like the case of Mayor Nomak in 1990, or of Jorge Carpio Nicol against the president who was his own cousin, Ramiro de Leon Carpio. This murder, if not clarified, is not only a threat to all of us in the human rights community, but it's also a threat to democracy and a threat to the power of the civilian government.
Right now, can you tell us the response in the week? For example, who came to the funeral? Are people afraid of coming out? And are people afraid of continuing with the Recuperation of Historic Memory project, the REMI project that produced Guatemala Never Again? What kind of protection do you have?
Well, people are very scared, again, because we all had the impression that something like this could not happen after the signing of the peace, after December of 1996. And the report itself was called Never Again. And 3 days later, one of the most horrendous political murders is committed. We make the analogy saying that the murder of Bishop Gerardi in Guatemala is equivalent to the murder of Bishop Romero in El Salvador, but with one big difference. Bishop Romero was murdered during the conflict, during the war in El Salvador. Bishop Gerardi has been murdered during peace, at a moment when no one thought that this could happen again. And it has. So I think that the fear that it has provoked is intense, but at the same time, the challenge to the government is enormous, because if the government doesn't clarify this incident, then we can say that we bury the peace process at the same time that we're burying Bishop Gerardi.
What about, Frank LaRue, what about the suspect that the Guatemalan government took in very quickly? I hear, at least here in the United States, that many are quite suspicious of who the government has taken and don't quite believe that he's the person responsible.
This is true. These type of crimes, you investigate in two ways, from the bottom up, from the crime scene, but you also investigate from the top down. And here, I mean, you go to all the different people in authority, in the security forces, and those with power, and you investigate who could have had from there down the motive, and this will give you a better investigation. The initial investigation, by the way, by the public ministry, by the Attorney General's office, totally destroyed the evidence. They walked over the marks on the ground. They manipulated the concrete block that had been used to kill Bishop Gerardi. They totally destroyed any serious evidence, and the FBI has now come 5 days later, but it'll be very difficult to find any further evidence. This is why people do not believe that the person they have just captured now is the right person. I mean, obviously, they can pick up anyone from the street and say, we have a suspect, in order to calm the protests and the demands of the population. But no one truly believes it. I mean, this was a political murder with a tremendous implication of conspiracy, and the government is not taking that route, is trying to prove that this was a simple common crime.
We're talking to Frank LaRue. He is a Guatemalan lawyer who is and has been for many years in danger himself, going back and forth between Guatemala and the United States, certainly a target of many in the paramilitaries and the military, considering his work representing human rights activists and as a human rights activist himself. I'm looking at a summary of the information contained in the REMI report, Guatemala Never Again. Again, REMI standing for Recuperation of Historic Memory. And some of the statistical results said, and this is from the Catholic Church of Guatemala, the direct victims of the war are approximately 150,000 dead, 50,000 disappeared, 1 million refugees, 200,000 orphan children, and 40,000 women widowed, a total of 1,440,000 victims in Guatemala. Is this the first time that this has been laid out in this way, talking about 200,000 people dead or disappeared?
Well, it's the first time that it's laid out so clearly. We have been sort of speculating at several numbers and statistics. But what makes this report, I think, really more relevant is the fact that it's backed with the testimonies and the reflection of the communities, especially in rural Guatemala. We all knew that we lived through very tragic years, especially the decade of the 80s. But beyond that, I think it's more important to read what the communities themselves lived through, what they went through. And this is the power of the REMI, to understand that Guatemala really suffered genocide in certain periods, and that this is still very present in the minds and the souls of the Christian communities of Guatemala.
I was also this weekend talking to Carlos Salinas of Amnesty International, and he told me that on May 11th in Washington, D.C., there is going to be a hearing on a bill that is called the Human Rights Information Act. This is something that Guatemalan activists in particular have been calling for, the Human Rights Information Act, which would release, declassify U.S. government documents about human rights violations in Honduras and Guatemala. And survivors of torture, disappearances, and killings may learn the details of what happened to them or their loved ones from this documentation. how much difference would it make to you in Guatemala trying to find out exactly what's happened over these four decades to get this information from the United States, to get this information from, for example, the Central Intelligence Agency?
It makes an enormous difference. It is very limited what we can investigate here because obviously the military don't open up their files. The government is not terribly keen on allowing people to investigate. So we have to do it basically on testimonies of individuals, of those that suffered the violence. But we don't have access to official information in terms of who were the leaders at that moment, who were the heads of garrison and of regions. So the information that the U.S. has is very, very important to determining the truth in Guatemala. And I would think that a big contribution to establishing the truth and to building democracy out of that would be to release that information. That would be more important than sending the FBI to investigate why Bishop Gerardi was now murdered. I think that if the U.S. government is really committed to the peace process and really committed to building democracy, they should open up that information of the past. Obviously, some of that information is also complicated for the role of the U.S. itself. But I believe that this is very important to maintain in order to really build the democracy out of truth.
Again, we're talking to Frank LaRue. He is a Guatemalan attorney speaking to us from Guatemala City. What is going to happen now with the REMI project? Will the other bishops carry on?
Yes. I must say that we have a very good conference of bishops of Guatemala, and they have reacted very much in unison. They are real pastors of their church. And I believe they're very shocked. They're very moved. But at the same time, they're very determined to follow the role of Bishop Gerardi, who was within them the person responsible of the report of the historic memory, but also of the human rights projects. They will have to find someone to follow that role. But there's many bishops in Guatemala that have been very outspoken on human rights, on land rights, on labor rights. And we truly believe that this conference of bishops will be up to task. And they are now talking about the martyr of the truth and following, like I said, his message and his role, his legacy given to this conference of bishops is enormous, and I think the Conference of Bishops will definitely continue the work.
Well, Frank LaRue, I want to thank you very much for joining us. Frank LaRue, Guatemalan attorney, talking about the assassination of Bishop Gerardi two Sundays ago in Guatemala. And we will continue to look out the fallout of that and to report on the information that comes out around what the Guatemalan military has done to its people over the last four decades, and also look at how much information the United States is willing to declassify to help people find out who is responsible. You are listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! And right now, we're going to turn to an interview I did this weekend up in the community of Harvard, Massachusetts. It's about 30 miles outside of Boston. I had a chance this weekend to go up to speak to an international group called Peace Brigades International. And they're a group that formed about 15 years ago that are in a number of countries in the world, and they accompany human rights activists. They are there to protect them, as they were in Guatemala for many years. In fact, they continue a project there. I spoke with Liam Mahoney, who's been with Peace Brigades International for 11 years, and he's also co-written a book on the group called Unarmed Bodyguards, International Accompaniment for the Protection of Human Rights. I asked him to start off by talking about just what Peace Brigades International does.
Peace Brigades has been in Guatemala since 1983, and we went into Guatemala during some of the worst period of the horrific violence that occurred in the early 1980s. And the work, the project we developed was actually suggested to us by Guatemalans who were fearful of being killed. They asked if we would provide volunteers to just accompany people who were being threatened, based on the belief that no matter how horrifying the crimes were that their government was committing, they felt that they would be less likely to be attacked if there was a foreign volunteer with them who was willing to witness and report whatever happened to the outside world, because they knew that the government was still vulnerable to outside pressure and outside opinion. And that turned out to be an incredibly powerful protective tool. And over the last 15 years in Guatemala, Peace Brigades volunteers have accompanied hundreds of activists and organizations who, during this period, have built a very powerful civilian democratic movement out of literally the ashes of one of the worst state terror systems in history.
One of the people that your group accompanied was Ninetta Garcia, the founder of the GOM. Can you explain what that group is and why Peace Brigades made such a difference in her own life?
Mm-hmm. The GOM, which is the Grupo de Apoyo Mutuo, or the Mutual Support Group for Families of Disappeared People. And it's a very powerful historic group in Guatemala because it was the very first human rights group to come into existence in the early 80s after the terrible violence, and really the first human rights group to ever survive. And when they'd been working for less than a year, they had several of their leaders assassinated. And that was when they came to Peace Brigades and said, we would like personal escorts, personal accompaniment for the remaining leadership, or we'll have to shut down. It's just too much danger. And they survived, and none of the other leaders were killed once Peace Brigades began accompanying them. And that was a real message to all of the Guatemalan civilian movement. People who were mostly scared to do any organizing saw here was a group that was risking the impossible, what was called almost suicidal, which was to speak out about disappearances and human rights abuse in the mid-1980s in Guatemala. And yet they survived, and they kept talking, and they opened the door for people to start organizing again for human rights in Guatemala. And so other people began to come to us talking about new organizations and union groups and farmers organizations and all kinds of civilian groups that were starting to overcome the fear that they developed from as a result of all the violence.
How do you recruit people to do this? Because while you as Westerners, particularly U.S. citizens, are not in as much danger as, in this case, Guatemalans, who you are protecting or accompanying, protecting just by your presence, you are putting yourself in the line of danger.
Well, we're putting ourselves in danger, but it is true that most of us don't feel that danger too directly because it is so clear that the people we're accompanying are in so much more danger. And danger is a pretty relative thing, and it's very hard to measure. But we still do have to address the fact that it's a risk. We're risking our lives. And we do a pretty intensive training process to select volunteers and to talk about the potential risks and to really have each person who considers this work do a little soul-searching to decide that working for the protection of human rights is worth taking a certain amount of risk for.
It's interesting. In a way, I see you as the shield representing the country that is the sword in so many of these conflicts. In the case of Guatemala, the U.S. government for so many years supporting the military regimes, and yet here you are U.S. citizens who are going down and being the human shield against that sword.
I would say sort of yes and no to that, which is, on the one hand, a lot of us, particularly those of us who are from the United States, like myself, we do feel that we are in some ways redressing a wrong that our own government is doing. We're going down there and trying to have some positive impact to help people overcome and resist all the violence that's been supported by our own government. And there's no doubt that the United States government has been fundamentally involved at the root of the violence in Guatemala. On the other hand, Peace Brigades International is just that. It's international. And we've had volunteers from all over the world and from third world countries as well and from other Latin American countries. And they, too, have been able to provide this same protection. And Guatemalans have felt as protected. And what we've learned from this experience is that what's protecting people is not, for instance, my U.S. citizenship, but the fact that we as an organization are linked to an international community that is now mobilized and ready to respond to human rights abuse.
Liam Mahoney is our guest. We'll come back with him in just a minute. Unarmed Bodyguards is the name of his book that he's written with Luis Enrique Eguren, and it is about international accompaniment for the protection of human rights. You're listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! We'll be back in a minute. We'll be right back.
Liam Mahoney, you are a member of Peace Brigades for the last 11 years, and you've also written this book, Unarmed Bodyguards, that's published by Kumarian Press. And as an author, as a researcher there, you interviewed Guatemalan military, you interviewed some of the leading generals, some of the leading killers over the last few decades. What was that like?
When we set out to write this book, we realized that one of the hardest things we faced was, how do you prove that accompaniment works? Because you can hang out accompanying someone for a really long time and they're still alive, but it doesn't necessarily prove that they're still alive because you were there. And we realized that what we had to do to make a strong case for the power of this tool was we had to talk to the people who were making the decisions about violence and see how they felt and thought about international organizations and the international human rights community. So we set out to talk to military generals, former dictators, former presidents in all the countries we studied, in Guatemala, not only Guatemala, but El Salvador, Sri Lanka, Colombia, and Haiti. And we found a lot of surprising things in these interviews. One, we found they were all interested in talking to us, that we didn't expect. We didn't think they'd be willing to talk to us at all about human rights work. But they were very interested in sharing their side of the story and sort of justifying their history. And we spoke with former dictator of Guatemala, who explained how he felt about human rights organizations, and he didn't like them very much at all, and more or less called us communists and terrorists even in the course of the interview.
This was Mejia?
This was Mejia Victorres, the last dictator in the early 80s in Guatemala. But in the course of the same interview, he also shared enough analysis of how the international system works to make it very clear that he knew he had to listen to the international human rights community and deal with damage control about the crimes that his government was committing. And later governments were even more and more sensitive. We had one general, General Hector Gramajo, who in fact has been found guilty in federal court in the United States of human rights abuse. He explained to us in a diagram how the whole international human rights community functions and lobbies and puts pressure on, and how they have to calculate the cost of each thing that goes wrong and how to figure out which things need damage control and which don't. It was an amazing sort of lecture he gave us, which clearly demonstrated that at the highest levels of decision in some of the most horrific terror machines in the world, people are calculating how to deal with the power of the human rights community. And that's why accompaniment works, because they're up there trying to make those decisions and figure out the cost. And they logically will decide because of that, we hope all the time, but certainly most of the time, that it's not going to be in their interest to kill someone when we're standing by them watching.
We're talking to Liam Mahoney, and he is the author of Unarmed Bodyguards, International Accompaniment for the Protection of Human Rights. Now, you got to stay in Guatemala for a long time, but there's another country you write about and that Peace Brigades International has been in for a while, and in some cases quite effectively, Sri Lanka, that you're now pulling out of. But can you talk about the situation in Sri Lanka and why it is you're leaving?
Peace Brigades went into Sri Lanka at the height of just one of the most horrifying human rights situations in recent history, worse than anything we'd faced even in Central America. In 1989, there were tens of thousands of people being killed and bodies left on the streets all over Sri Lanka. And the lawyers, the Bar Association of Sri Lanka, asked us to go in there and accompany lawyers who were trying to work for the rights of detained and disappeared people. And so we entered and began accompanying people and played a really important role in helping people to start to confront the impunity of what the government was doing and to start to bring cases against people who were committing human rights abuse. But what we found also was that very quickly the situation changed in Sri Lanka, and the government was sophisticated enough to realize as human rights pressure grew that they had to sort of lay low with the human rights abuse against activists of the sort of people we were accompanying. And so in more recent years, we found fewer and fewer people felt they needed accompaniment, that people weren't asking us for accompaniment anymore because they felt like although there was still this terrible war going on, the government wasn't going to attack them just because they were doing human rights work, and so they didn't need it. Meanwhile, other parts of the country where the war was the hottest, we knew there would also be important work we could do there, but the government and the Tamil Tigers, who controlled some of the territory in the country as well, there was no way we could get into certain regions where we could be effective. And we did have to realize in Sri Lanka that the kind of work we do is only effective if there are certain concessions already made by whoever is in charge. A government has to tolerate our presence. In this case, the government did not want to tolerate our presence in the war zone. They were happy for us to be sort of out of the way where the war wasn't happening. But to be out where the war was really happening, they just kept putting conditions and blockades that made it impossible for us to work. So we decided it was time that we needed to leave. Strangely, even while we were making that decision, the government took an even more intense step and essentially expelled us from the country by putting very harsh conditions on all information that we allowed we wrote about the international situation. So we sort of had to abruptly leave Sri Lanka just this month.
The government said that you had to reveal who all your sources were in the country and that they would have to vet anything that you wrote, any information you put out on Sri Lanka?
Exactly. And just recently, we've sent a formal letter to the president of Sri Lanka explaining that those sorts of conditions, although they may believe that they're necessary because they're fighting a war, those sorts of conditions controlling information and controlling witnesses, international witnesses of human rights situations, those steps are not going to be helpful for Sri Lanka and for the fulfillment of democracy and human rights there. And I think it's an important point is that Sri Lanka has a democratic system and has a real hope for achieving a situation of respect for human rights. It's much more developed in that respect than many countries we've worked in Latin America. But because they're facing a war, the military begins to have a much bigger role on deciding civilian policies like this, of what international organizations can do, et cetera. And the military doesn't have a sense of democracy, and they're the ones who did not want us working in the regions of the war.
Are you concerned that this could set a precedent, that other governments can say, they kicked them out there just by putting some restrictions on them. Let's all do this. I mean, it wouldn't be so hard to get rid of you everywhere.
Well, I think it does create a precedent, except that we have been thrown out of other places before, and we've often gone back because we did feel that the work was too important, and we are always able to get back if we put enough pressure on. In the Sri Lankan case, we've decided we're not going back because, for the other reasons I mentioned, we'd already seen the work was no longer as necessary in the places we could work. It is possible that successfully throwing us out will weaken us in other places. But on the other hand, we've had much more dramatic expulsions from countries that we've responded to with huge amounts of lobbying pressure, and governments have seen that it's not in their interest to do that.
Like what countries?
In both Salvador and Guatemala at different times, we've had our entire team thrown out of the country. And the two ways that we responded to that I think are both effective for not encouraging governments to do this. One is just mere persistence. You get thrown out, you go back in. You get thrown out, you go back in. You just keep going back in, and a government will eventually realize that it's not particularly worth the trouble to keep throwing out a group that isn't going to leave. And then they have to decide whether they're going to up the ante and attack you in a worse way. For instance, physical attack or killing, which we have not faced killing. The other way is that we immediately, when we're expelled, we get international pressure. We get Congress people and high-level people to contact a government and point out that this is not good for their image and it's going to embarrass them. And governments don't want that kind of pressure. So when this happened in Guatemala, we were able to respond very quickly and get a team back in almost immediately. And in El Salvador, it happened in 1989 during one of the worst moments of the war, and it took us 5 months to get back into the country. But in those 5 months were somewhat embarrassing for the Salvadoran government, who were getting a constant barrage of pressure to let us back in.
In the case of Guatemala, with the assassination of Bishop Herardi, do you expect to get more requests for accompaniment? I mean, he was in the midst of this REMI project, this project on the recuperation of historic memory, and others are involved with it too. I mean, bishops and especially religious people in the Catholic Church all over Guatemala.
I would expect it is quite possible we would get more requests. My hope would be that that sort of response would be short term, and I'd like to explain that. It's really important. One of the things we documented in our book and really studied a lot is the psychological impact of this kind of terror and the fact that people are fearful for decades after living through terror. And one of the great values of the project that Herardi was working on, the recuperation of historic memory, was that it was trying to help the entire society overcome its fear. And the reason killing a man like that is so powerful in Guatemala is because whoever killed him is making a statement to all of society in Guatemala. They're saying, "We will never let you not be afraid." That's the statement of killing a man like that who had just done that project. But something like that was just attempted a few years ago in Guatemala. There was a massacre of a refugee community a few years after the refugees began to go back into Guatemala. And again, everyone felt that that massacre was going to just shut down the entire civilian movement because people would be too fearful again to organize. But in fact, the result was the opposite. People were sufficiently organized, had gone past a certain threshold of organization, that their fear couldn't be reactivated as easily as people thought. And instead, it was completely counterproductive. I think that this killing of Harati will be completely counterproductive for the military and the right wing in Guatemala, because people have passed several thresholds of organizing in Guatemala and overcome a lot of fear already. Some people will, for the short term, just close down and be afraid because this was extremely high-level killing. But mostly people are going to be very angry and even more committed to keeping the civilian democracy alive.
If people want to get involved with this work, with Peace Brigades International, which is not only going to countries and making a commitment of, say, half a year or a year, but being the support back here when emergency press releases are sent out or emergency actions are called for, where can they call?
Peace Brigades has a national office for its United States chapter, and they're based in Berkeley. The number there is 510-540-0749.
One more time.
510-540-0749.
And if people want to get a hold of the book, Unarmed Bodyguards, International Accompaniment for the Protection of Human Rights, which is put out by Kumarian Press.
The place to call directly and get it right away is the press, the publisher itself. Kumarian Press has an 800 number for orders. It's 1-800-289-2664, and they'll get it out to you right away.
That's 1-800-289-2664. Leah Mahoney, thank you for writing the book, Unarmed Bodyguards, and thank you for joining us today.
Thank you.
You are listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. As we go to our last segment of today's show, on April 1st, we kicked off the beginning of the new commentaries written but not spoken by journalist and death row prisoner Mumia Abu-Jamal, called All Things Censored. In November 96, the Pennsylvania Department of Corrections banned all journalists from auto-recording, videotaping, or photographing any prisoner in a state facility. Democracy Now! Aired the last permitted recordings of Mumia Abu-Jamal last year. Mumia Abu-Jamal was convicted in 1981 of killing police officer Daniel Faulkner. He's been on death row for 16 years. He maintains his innocence, and many around the world are calling for a new trial. All Things Censored is produced by the Prison Radio Project. Today, the commentary of Mumia Abu-Jamal, read by actor Peter Coyote.
My name is Peter Coyote. Mumia Abu-Jamal's deep and resonant words have been silenced and censored. This essay was handwritten in a solitary confinement cell by a man awaiting execution. Prison officials have banned Mumia's voice, and so I would like to read you one of his illuminating commentaries that Senator Bob Dole and National Public Radio have tried to banish from the airwaves. Meeting with a Killer. In Philadelphia, Hank Fay's name is Mud. Convicted of the 1981 rape-slaying of a girl child and subsequently sentenced to death, Fay has lived in a virtual netherworld beneath the usual hell that is death row. Marked as a baby rapist, he has had to withstand the loathing of the many who regard his crime as an act beneath contempt. Fay's odyssey into the underworld has not been an easy one. Bouts of suicide attempts have alternated with periods of an almost manic evangelical fervor, a living pendulum swinging between visions of hell and heaven, both just beyond his grasp. In late June 1995, while under his second death warrant and with a date to die in July, Hank would come face to face with the living personifications of his demons and his angel. Even while under an active death warrant, with a date to die within 2 weeks, Fay was transferred to a Philadelphia city prison rather than the state prison at Greaterford, as is customary. When he arrived, he was placed in a cell where the words, "Jamie Fay, rest in peace," were scrawled across the wall. Jamie Fay, a beautiful, troubled, love-starved young girl, beaten, murdered, and allegedly raped, was Hank Fay's 18-year-old daughter. She was barely 4 when he entered hell. There's more. From impish whisperings of those around him, he learned an astonishing fact, that the man charged with beating, killing, and raping his daughter was at this prison, and not merely in the same prison, but on the very same cell block. As if inevitable, Hank met Mark. And the hatred kindled over years melted into a rare compassion. "I hated him, Jamal," Fay confided. "But when I saw this kid, 18 years old, I realized what a hell he was in for. And also, I thought about the pain I'd be causing his mother if I took something and struck him. In every prison in America, murder is no mystery. There are men on death row across the nation awaiting execution for killings committed in prison. Hank had 2 weeks of life left. What did he have to lose? You know, Jamal, I looked at this 18-year-old kid, and I remembered the look on my mother's face when she was alive, when she came to visit me, the shame of seeing her son on death row. And I didn't have the heart to tell this kid, but I could see his mother looking at him the same way. And it hurt me, Jamal. It really did, man. What hurt you, Hank? What you mean? Well, it was two things. First, this was a setup. I was supposed to kill this kid. Why else would they put us on the same block? Come on, man. Second, the same people that put me on death row are going to put this kid on death row, but he don't know it yet. What did you tell Mark? I told him I forgive you. And I told him to let his lawyer know it, and anything I can do to help him and keep him off death row, I'll do. How did you feel telling that boy that, Hank? You know, Jamal, I felt good. I felt like the better man, because the same system that plans to kill me, that plans to kill him, that same system that set us both up for me to kill him and for him to get killed, can't do what I did, forgive. I loved my daughter, Jamal. She was my heart. But me killing that kid can't bring my Jamie back. And you know what else, Jamal? What's that, Hank? I wouldn't wish death row on my worst enemy.
Peter Coyote reading the commentary of Mumia Abu-Jamal. All Things Censored produced this series with us that we'll be running at the beginning of every month. If you'd like a copy of today's show, you can call 1-800-735-0230. That's 1-800-735-0230. Democracy Now! Is produced by Hisu Ku and Jeremy Scahill. Errol Maitland's our technical director. Julie Drizin, our executive producer. From the studios of WBAI, I'm Amy Goodman for another edition of Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now!